This is tape 4, side B of the Open University course English 102, Composition in Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, Patty Hartford talks to Lee Marichal, the author of Education, which is taken from her 1988 book of essays, I Am Woman. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby, BC on February 19, 1993. Lee Marichal is in Vancouver for a reading, and we reach her on the telephone at her hotel. Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops.
Now, I guess our students might be interested to know that you're living in Toronto, but you're talking to us from beautiful downtown Vancouver.
Yeah, it's not so cold here.
And you're in town to...
I'm addressing the Women in the Law Conference. The theme this year is Healing the Path.
Interesting. Is that at UBC?
No, it's actually at the Sheraton Landmark. It's a hotel on Robson.
Good.
Quite a nice hotel, actually.
So, as I've looked at some of the things that you've read, some of the variety of things that you've written, I'm just fascinated to know what got you started writing.
I think it was sort of a conspiracy on my relative's part in some ways. In the 50s, I think you've probably heard of Dan George, and he did a poem about how the children of the future will pick up pens and write our story, and the world will be a better place for it. I was very influenced by that, coming from North Van and knowing Dan and so forth, and so was my mother. And I was given a lot of leeway as a child to read and to write, particularly after I was 9 years old. And that kind of translated into getting out of work, for one. I didn't have to dig crabs if I was writing or reading. So I was really encouraged. And I wanted to be a writer when I was quite small. I loved the storytellers that still were alive when I was, before I went to school, Kafalono and Ehop were nearly 100. Grandpa Thomas was 104. They were amazing, very poetic storytellers, amazing speakers. And I wanted to be able to write from that cultural perspective when I was really very young. Then I discovered poetry, specifically Bliss Carman. I can remember that was the first thing I ever read in school that I thought I understood.
Obviously, some of your writing is very autobiographical, very personal. I just received, but haven't read yet, a copy of Sundogs. But in your fiction, do you write about things that happen to you personally?
Not a lot, actually. I do put myself as I usually write in the I form. And I do drag on my experience under similar circumstances. You know, my understanding of what's unfolding in my fiction is personal. My perspective on the events are personal. But I don't usually use myself that often, as people think. Sundogs, did you read it?
No, not yet. I just got it.
Okay, well, one of the characters is an older lady, and she is based on my mother's character. Her character, her personality, is very much like my mother. However, the whole circumstances are pure fiction. I create a non-existent family that's suffering from, you know, social breakdown and cultural disarray. Particularly a young university student who's alienated from the family in general. And all the events take place during 1990, during Elijah Harper and the Oka crisis and so on. But the perspective of the young girl is not from a sympathy for Elijah or Indian people. not till the book is over. So it's kind of a really different perspective that she's coming from than mine. Mine was wholly sympathetic at the time, and of course she's young. However, my daughter did participate in the run that is featured in the story, even though none of the things that happened on the run are necessarily that factual. Some of them are her feelings about Terry Fox. The young girl's feelings about Terry Fox are kind of a composite of my feelings about him and my daughter's and my mother's. That forms part of the story. So in some ways I pull up on my own feelings, the feelings of my family around events that have shaped our lives, and I use them in my fiction.
So essentially, I think what you're saying is you've done what one of my university professors used to call sacrificing truth with a small t for truth with a capital T.
Yeah, I think I really struggle to do that. And Sojourner's Truth, I don't know if you've read any of those fictional pieces. But no one in that book is non-existent in a certain sense, mm-hmm. although it's not autobiographical. I think there's one in there that is actually autobiographical. It's about the only one that unfolded kind of exactly as it happened. That was Leon's spiritual experience, which is a little kind of tongue-in-cheek anecdote to lighten up the rest of the book.
What do you think is the most important thing for Native people to write about?
I'm not sure about write about. I mean, I think all writers should create characters and should address from within themselves the world around them and try to humanize the world in some way. So issues, I think, become a part of story. But I don't think anyone should write about issues in fiction. I think we need a lot more writers that are going to tackle issues non-fictionally and creatively. I think I Am Woman's attempt to do that, a creative approach to non-fiction writing and political theory and social issues. I tried to integrate fiction into it on occasion to illustrate the impact of social condition on the individual. And I rely on fiction in my nonfiction writing. But I think that writers should be really, really creative and dig deep inside themselves for an approach to how our lives is going now and how it was before and how it can be different tomorrow.
So what's your feeling about non-Native writers writing fiction about Native people?
Okay, that's a complex question. I want to take it into two parts. First of all, I think that non-Native writers should write about anybody they create. However, the exigencies, I guess, of literary writing is that you should do it well or be open to criticism, and you should do it from an internal understanding or be open to literary criticism. I think a great deal of white writers that take on Indian characters do so from either a patronizing or an out-and-out racist or a sexist position. And I think that before you take on someone else's life, that you have to really search your soul, irregardless of what color the person is, or be open to literary criticism. That isn't to say that I wouldn't call that appropriation. I know a lot of people are calling it appropriation and are misinterpreting what we are, you know, what we are concerned about as appropriation of culture with that, mixing the two things up. For me, it's a wide open field. I feel just as free creating a white character, and I have, as I feel free to create an Indian character. However, I'm also very sensitive that If I use a white man, as in the case of Sojourner's Truth, then I better find a way to redeem him and not just diatribe and put him in a small box he can't get out of, because then I end up being racist and anti-male, sexist and anti-male way. Even though I may not know a white man that has actually redeemed himself in that fashion, I can still imagine what it would be like for him to die and retrace his life and come to a sense of peace and justice about the world. I can imagine that. And I think it's the same when a white person's writing about Indian people. And I don't think there's a lot of struggle from white writers to come to grips with that, the future of the character they're creating, the sense of the heroic in human beings generally is not a big thing on their list of how-tos in terms of writing. But that's just a personal principle with me. The other side of that question is appropriation, where white people have taken our stories and pretended that they're Indian and written it. And I think that's just literally dishonest, and I think it is appropriation. When I give someone a storyline, that's half the battle. And if I'm not considered a co-author, then I feel robbed, and I think that's happened quite a lot. And it's a very separate issue.
Are you talking here about, say, people like Kinsella who use a first-person native narrator?
I think Kinsella's a racist. I think he's a racist and a sexist. And he takes events in our lives and makes very racial and sexual light of them. His Dance Me Outside makes fun of rape and murder of a real woman whose name was Rosemary Roper. I don't think that's appropriation. I think that's really insensitive and poor literature. And I'm really, really distressed that he wins, you know, prizes for humor around laughing at us in that fashion. I think it's a real indication of the depth of the illness of racism and sexism in this society that Canadians find him amusing. But I think that's a different issue than appropriation. I'm speaking of appropriation when someone comes in, takes a Raven story that belongs to us, writes it up, publishes it as their own, and collects the coinage from it, when they didn't imagine the story in the first place, and it's rooted in our culture in the second place. I guess that's a whole issue of appropriation, which is actually a polite word for stealing.
Well, we know who you don't like now.
Yeah, you don't care for Kinsella too much.
I appreciate your honesty. Who are some of your favorite writers?
My favorite writers, well, I guess besides myself, eh?
Yeah, of course.
I think I really like Zola Germinal. I really like that. I think it opened me up to being sensitive to white people. And it transformed a real deep anger and hate for them into a kind of empathy and compassion. If you have origins like that, I can then understand how you can come to my homeland and be quite brutal, because your origins are brutal. It's sort of like that for me with Chekhov and like that as well. The historical, I guess the classical writers of the 19th century really helped me to understand this world that exists now quite a bit and to understand the people in it. So I really like those writers for their transformative character. But I also like men like Ken Kesey, who did The Cuckoo's Nest. And he was very, very delicate in laughing at the system, rather than at the victims of the system in that piece of work. And there are some real hilarious sections in that book that that give you a break from the omnipotent sort of face of the mental health care system at the time. So I like that.
Now, you mentioned your favorite writer, of course. What do you think is your own best work?
Oh, gee. I think for me, I guess I'm not going to call it my best work. I'm going to call it the work that put me on the path I wanted to be on. And that's I Am Woman. It brings my analytic in line with my story, which was a 15-year struggle for me, because all of our stories are stories that are about law, stories about politics, stories about social conduct, or I guess sociology in your language. They're governing stories, and they fuse an analytic, a sense of theory, a sense of philosophy into the story. So I always wanted to do that in my writing. And before I Am Woman, theoretical social criticism, nonfiction writing, and fiction were very, very separate in my mind as a result of my education in English. And it was a struggle to come back to bringing all those things together holistically. So that now I think Sundogs is the sort of outcome of that, a really great outcome as a novel. I achieved something, but it kicked off with I Am Woman, in taking nonfiction and coming at it from story. And then taking Sundogs was kind of taking a story, but coming at it sociologically.
You know, when we were trying to isolate literature to be used in this course, in which we study primarily short stories and essays,
mm-hmm.
As I talked to people, almost everyone I talked to said, you have to include something from I Am Woman, that it's absolutely necessary in order to get a good picture, a good cross-section of Native thought, and particularly of what Native women are writing. And your name came up repeatedly. I'd like to know what kind of feedback you get from critics, from your own peers, from mm-hmm. your family, from critics, actually, who are writing about your work.
Well, the thing that people say to me about I Am Woman, whether they're men or women, is that it was an empowering work, and it was a liberating work, and it took them out of them of whatever morass they were in and demoralized state they were in, and gave them the I can do it, and led them to another path. There's about 27 healing Native women's healing circles in this country since the publication of I Am Woman, and almost all of the women that started the healing circles were women who read the book. So that's a huge yes for me, I guess.
Have you had a different response, say, from Native people as opposed to non-Native people?
No, actually, the Native women who read it and the white women who read it all have basically the same thing to say. I've had one criticism of all the letters and such that I've gotten from people. I've had only one criticism, and that was that I wasn't hard enough on white men. But all the rest of the people that have read it, including teachers and one of them a PhD in education, were tremendously empowered and moved and liberated by it. They felt that someone was speaking to them from the heart about law and politics and society in general.
How have men responded?
Well, the men that I've spoken to, is the first time, most of them have said something along these lines, it's the first time they felt someone's political position was coming from the heart. And that it was really, on the one hand, unnerving, but on the other hand, they were moved as well.
I guess I'm going to ask you to read a passage from Education, and then I just have so many questions, so many more questions I want to ask you. But the essay Education is the one that we're using in the course.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to just choose any short passage from there that you'd like to read.
Oh, I think I'll read the first part. When our grandmothers sent their children to school, it was with self-sufficiency and mastery over the production of new things in mind. They did not realize that we would never be taught to create the iron cooking pots from the ore of the earth. This is the third generation of our education, and our children know less about the production of the stuff of life than our grandmothers. Schools have showed themselves to be ideological processing plants, turning out young people that cannot produce the means to sustain themselves, but who are full from cover to cover with the ideological nonsense of European culture.
Okay. Later in the essay, you talk about, I'm quoting here, you say, change must be the basis for education and cultural development. Do you see progress and change in the education both Native and non-Native people are receiving today compared to, say, 5 years ago?
Not a lot of fundamental change. I think that just as a real short example, I had to teach a half dozen young children who were 12 years old, who still didn't know how to read and write. And they were Native kids. And in 3 days, they were all reading novels. It was the nature of the teaching, the pedagogical methods themselves, that this allowed them from learning. And I don't think that the education system questions its pedagogical methodology. I think the changes happen in the kind of things that are taught occasionally. Some schools are now doing, you know, Native studies as supplementary education and so on. But the very approach to education, the very way in which knowledge is imparted, is not questioned. It's extremely disempowering in my life to sit with someone at the front lecturing constantly, like a steady drip of water, as though I weren't a participant in this process, as though I had nothing to contribute to this process called learning. There's no exchange in the learning process. And that's fairly universal. Instead of that approach, I think that you know, some questioning of the approach has to happen, and children have to become a part of a learning process. And I've been doing quite a bit of that kind of teaching in Native communities, particularly among adults, around writing and so forth. I'm calling it empowerment through the arts as well, to help our kids get past the disempowerment that happens in the very nature of education, the very nature of teaching.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Oh, thank you.
Your earlier work, it sounds so angry to me, and you've alluded to that already. I'm just wondering if there was a writer or philosopher who strongly influenced you in your earlier writing years.
I don't feel very influenced by anyone, actually. At that time that I was doing Bobby Lee, I actually felt tremendously alone, like a piss in the wind. And I don't feel so much like that now. I think that's probably where the anger was coming from. because at the time my thinking was so considered so bizarre by a lot of people. And I had done some, you know, publishing and gotten literally attacked by, you know, the left and the right at the time. And the women in the women's community as well, around some of my thinking, and including my own people. So I felt pretty alone as a thinker. And most of the work that was going on, I think if there was anybody, it was maybe C. Wright Mills, who's an American sociologist. He wrote an essay called Sociological Imagination, in which he pleads with American thinkers and intellectuals to be more creative about their thinking and less stuck on whose school of thought they ascribe to. So that was validating for me. I guess that's sort of how I am. I look for people who validate my own thinking rather than find myself influenced by others. I'm influenced culturally from inside my own culture, so I have to say that. I have to say that, you know, men like Dan George and Catalano were a powerful influence in my life in my early years. But once you have some set of values and set of philosophical origins, and you start to look around at the world and see that the world doesn't behave in accordance with even the most fundamental human values, then it puts you in a fighting position. And that's why that first work comes out angry, because it's a challenge. Like, this is what you did to us in the name of brotherhood and integration.
So, I Am Woman was published in 1988. Would you say anything differently today than the way you said it then?
Oh, yeah. There's parts of it that I would elaborate on. There's parts of it that I would alter, but not significantly. There's endless passages in I Am Woman that I still absolutely love. I love for the beauty of the presentation, the content, and the clarity. I think it's a very clear statement.
As I don't want to call you a spokeswoman or native women, but is there some theme or perhaps a few themes that you think are particularly important to Native women?
I think right now a lot of Native women are concerned with healing and empowerment, which is kind of interesting that I'm at this conference called Healing the Path. Our communities are suffering from huge social demoralization and disempowerment. And there's a real struggle by Native women to pick themselves up from the ashes of 100 years of colonial legacy and put our communities back together somehow. And so I think that I Am Woman, it was an important little arrow in that direction. I think that it came at a time when a lot of Native women were thinking about themselves as women and what had happened to them. It just came at the right time for a lot of us. So I suppose that work is now being realized and it's bearing fruit. And it's a long, slow, tedious re-education and rerouting ourselves in our culture, and then trying to find a way to modernize our culture. I think we suffered a lot of cultural arrest, and women are really in the forefront of that movement for the modernization of our culture and the reintegration of ourselves with ourselves.
Do you think that in general these themes are things that are of concern to women of all races?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the legacies of the colonial process and the racism in this country is that this country has not had access to our thinking. And that's a huge robbery. Which is why a lot of white people are reading books about Indians that are written by white people, because they think they've been robbed, I think unconsciously. They know they've been robbed. And there's a search for the Canadian self, which I believe that every Canadian, well, not, maybe not every, but a lot of Canadian people feel is linked to us in some way. Murdoch Burnett writes a very beautiful poem about that, in which he says, "I'm sitting by a river with two stones in hand, trying to remember, trying not to forget what might have been and never was." And it's called This Long Distance of Time. And it's about his own agonizing search for an Indian white identity that is something of both. And it doesn't exist in this country because the way society has structured itself, it is not capable right now of learning from us.
I have one last question, and then with a little addendum after that. Tell us about your writing since I Am Woman.
Oh, gosh. I've done a lot, actually. I did some really beautiful essays and speeches, which I'm going to eventually put together into a book. Not in the real near future, but one was used by The Sun recently, in which I take on Ecstasy of Rita Cho, which I love, and my daughter was the Rita Cho in it and won a Jessie for it. She's the first Indian to win a Jessie, which is an acting award out here. And I take on the creative imagination and good literature and the misunderstanding around appropriation that a lot of people are suffering from. It's also published in Fuse magazine, and I think this is probably going to print it. I've done work like that, really creative essays. I've done other short stories. There's another anthology of short stories Drew Taylor put together that I have a story in, called The Laundry Basket is Full Again, and it don't matter what race you are, that's a good story for women who want to come up from under a memory of divorce. I've done Sun Dogs, and recently I've done Raven Song, which is an interesting twining of an old story of ours with a novel about a young girl during the last epidemic of 54, and her sister, who has a magical sort of memory of previous epidemics and the impact of epidemics on our cultural breakdown and the grief around that. That's an unspoken kind of grief that our folks have to deal with. And it was a personal struggle, actually. I didn't realize how hard that particular piece of work would be. But it's done now, and it'll be out in the spring. I'm very, very pleased with the work.
Sounds like a real variety.
Yeah, I try to do a lot of things. I have to challenge myself to keep doing this stuff.
I suppose my next question refers not only to the essay education, which our students will be reading in this course, but I suppose to the whole of I Am Woman. If you were giving a student advice on how to look at the book, the essay in particular, what would you offer them?
Well, I think it's an emotional roller coaster ride. So if there's any pain in their life, it'll come up through the book. That's the first thing that I usually tell people. But the other thing is, just from a literary context, it's a real exercise in stretching the language beyond its usual structural limits and playing with thinking and being. And I don't mean that frivolously. The play is like a sword fight, or like an orchestra. It's a chance to really stretch the boundaries of language and stretch the imagination beyond what is.
That's great. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.